rockzone.com.
Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, welcome to Wild About Pets. This is the place we talk in depth to leading authors and experts about household pets or wild animals. To make your listening experience more enjoyable and meaningful, I have a companion website, wildaboutpets.net, that allows you to see photographs of the animals we'll be talking about on the show today. To see these pictures while you are listening, just click the purple Look While You Listen button that you see on the TalkZone.com website. Are you currently needing to train your dog? Well, of course you are. Dogs can always use more training, right? Are you confused, however, by all the different dog training methods, books, and trainers that are out there? I know I have been. Which to choose? You may have heard about the style called positive training, and that sounds right, but what does it actually mean? What is the difference between all the different methods, and does it really matter anyway? You just want your dog to do certain things and stop doing others. My guest today is Paul Owens, author of The Dog Whisperer, a compassionate, nonviolent approach to dog training, written with Norma Eckroat. Paul has been training dogs for 37 years, and he will tell you there are big differences and huge benefits. Welcome, Paul. I am thrilled to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Paul Owens is nationally recognized as a leading proponent of nonviolent training, promoting kindness, respect, and compassion. In addition to having written three books, he has produced two Dog Whisperer DVDs. Volume 1 was rated the best family dog training DVD on the market. I have some photos from the book The Dog Whisperer that we'll be talking about today. So again, if you want to see them while you're listening, click that purple Look While You Listen button that you see on the Talk Zone page. That will take you right to the photos that happen to be on my website, wildaboutpets.net. So you can look while you listen. The phone lines are open. We are streaming live. It's December 11th. If you'd like to call and ask Paul Owens a question, call 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888. Go for it. You'll also find that phone number at the top of my Look While You Listen page about today's show. You can also email me now at susan@wildaboutpets.net. Paul, what exactly is meant by nonviolent dog training?
Well, I think the easiest way to explain that is the golden rule, the old don't treat anybody or any animal any differently than you would like yourself treated. So obviously that would exclude any kind of physical punishment where you're hitting or jerking or hanging or shocking a dog, because that isn't something that you would do with yourself, with your family, your friends, your children, or any other family member. So nonviolence is basically treating a dog with kindness and compassion, but in order to do that, you obviously have to know the scientific methods to get your dogs to do what you want them to do. And so we do it all in a positive way rather than having to use physical punishment or physical corrections.
Okay, and I know during our conversation today we're going to get into those exact methods. So, Paul, nonviolent dog training is the same thing as the term positive training?
Well, that's true. That being said, people have different definitions for what positive means. Traditional dog training, which is what I did when I started back in the 70s, included leash corrections and pinning a dog to the ground and jerking them on a leash and things like that, as well as using praise and rewarding your dog with affection. And so you have to, whenever you talk to a professional dog trainer and they say they're positive, you have to be very specific and say, well, does that include these methods or those methods?
I see. Okay. And you do a great job, actually, in your book of illustrating and explaining exactly what you mean by that term. I know sometimes terms start floating around out there and they're very ambiguous and they do seem to encompass a lot, whether it's positive or nonviolent or not. Well, now, Paul, you know, I had a dog when I was growing up, and his name was Barney, and he was a beagle. And, of course, back then, you know, I was taught if your dog does something bad, you know, force his nose in it and swat him with the newspaper. Now, I know, at least I don't think that's being advocated any longer. You know, things change, we know, you know, and people become enlightened. But I know right now out in, you know, certain books, and if I watch different television shows, there are dog trainers still giving the advice about, you know, yes, when your dog is walking and it does something wrong, you, you know, do that quick jerk on the collar. And I don't know. I think, Paul, it's always what I was told you do. And so it's difficult because isn't, I think a lot of people think, well, that's just what you're supposed to do. How do we address that?
I did the same thing and taught those methods. I didn't start using treats with dogs until 1988. So I taught jerking on a leash and pinning a dog to the ground and doing those things for many years before I switched over to positive training. So the reason people do it is because a lot of times it seems to work. You can stop a dog from doing something you don't want them to do. The difference is this. In positive training, you don't correct the dog. You correct the dog's behavior. For example, if a dog is jumping up on you, the negative trainer might jerk the dog on the leash or knee the dog in the chest to get them to stop jumping. In positive training, what you do is teach the dog a substitute behavior. So instead of correcting the dog for jumping, you get them to do something else which solves the problem. For example, you have your dog sit or lie down or run to their bed, and then you solve the problem without having to correct the dog using physical punishment.
Okay, I know you say very clearly, and you have a great video on your website also that we'll refer to, that you're basically then responding to something versus reacting to your dog.
Exactly correct. Yeah, you don't react to your dog's behavior, you respond to it, so you don't correct the dog, you correct the dog's behavior. And the example that we just gave of jumping then, you are substituting the behavior you want for the behavior you don't want rather than trying to stop them from doing something.
Okay, well, now that sounds easy, and of course we'll have to find out how to do it, but is there any real danger or is there any harm in using some of the old methods that I'm sure a lot of dog owners are using today? Because let's face it, we do tend to want to react. So getting down to that question I asked in my introduction, what does it really matter? What is the danger or, again, the harm of using some of those kind of forceful, violent methods?
Well, it's a good question. A real professional who has the timing and the skills to work with a dog can actually use negative methods without harming the dog or harming the person. That being said, 99% of the people who just get a dog don't have those skills, and it ends up hurting the dog because if you have a sensitive dog, you can drive them more into their shell so they stop working with you because you didn't apply the correct intensity of the correction. It was too much for them, for example, and then the whole trust factor comes into play and the dog doesn't trust you or doesn't want to come towards you. If you have a more aggressive dog, the dog will bite you. So the timing, the intensity, the skills that you have as a trainer all factor into that. So not only is there a safety factor involved as far as physically harming the dog or physically harming the person, there's also an emotional factor involved, and you don't want to harm yourself or your dog. And if I, long-winded as this is, I might point out this type of training is not just about whether or not you can get a dog to do something. It's the process, the methods that you use actually help define your character as a human being.
Oh, okay. You talk about some of the research that has been done on what kind of physical ill effects that can occur from dogs from the jerking on their neck. Can you explain those a bit?
There was one study done, and admittedly, there haven't been a lot. There have been several in the last couple of years, but there have been one study that was done that showed that I believe it was more than 60% of dogs that had training with leash corrections, had problems with their spine, had problems with their muscles and the ligaments surrounding their back and or part of their back. And as a result, that pain or that discomfort directly affects the dog's behavior. And it gets to be a vicious circle because what happens is that the dog isn't feeling right, just like if we have a stubbed toe, we're not feeling at the top of our game. If the dog is physically feeling uncomfortable about something, then they can get more shy, they can get more standoffish, or they can get more aggressive.
Okay. We are looking at some photos that I have from your book, and right now I want to call attention to photo number 4, which shows an illustration that you drew, I understand, called The Triangle for Success. And this basically is what your book is structured on and organized, that you kind of have to take these three things, environment, positive associations, and positive reinforcement in. Can you briefly explain how we would think about this triangle for success?
Well, I rarely can briefly do anything. All right, set up the environment for success. You wouldn't allow your child to bolt out the door and run into traffic, so you would put up a baby gate. You would use baby gates for dogs. You wouldn't allow your child to jump up on somebody who comes in the door and just hang on their clothes. You would hold them by the hand, or the same thing, you would hold the child's hand before you cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing with a dog. If you don't want to put your dog in a situation where you have to correct them, so you would, instead of baby-proofing the house, you'd puppy-proof the house. You'd pick things up that the dog can get into their mouth and chew, or the TV remote, or your bunny slippers, or whatever. Number one, yeah, you set up the environment so your dog can't do the behavior, and that's done with baby gates and leashes, and that's the safe environment so your dog doesn't form any bad habits. So
makes sense.
One. Yep. Number two, positive associations. Dogs do everything in life based on associations. So let's say a pot drops on the floor. If you go, oh, I'm so sorry, I scared you, you poor little baby, let me kiss it and make it better, like some parents do when children fall off the swing, mm-hmm. and the child gets really scared. If you act that way, the dog then learns, look at all the attention I get for this behavior. I'm acting scared, I'm acting submissive, I'm acting fearful, and my human is giving me more attention than I ever get. So that's the association you don't want to make. So even though you feel like a crumb because you scared your poor little dog by dropping the pot on the floor, you have to be a good actress or a good actor. So when the pot drops and the dog gets scared, you go, hey, I bet you that was scary, and throw him a piece of chicken. The dog says, man, that wasn't so bad after all.
Okay.
So it's all about associations. Another dog is coming down the walk. You say, hey, look at that big black dog. Here's a piece of chicken. What happens? Within 21 to 28 days, your dog says, well, I love that guy. Every time he shows up, my human starts throwing chicken on the ground. So instead of wanting to chase that dog or running away from the dog, you've changed the association. So that's everything in the dog's life is about association. The third is positive reinforcement. It isn't how do you get your dog to stop doing something like jumping, as I mentioned earlier. It's what do you want your dog to do instead? So you ask your dog to sit. You ask your dog to lie down. You ask your dog to get you a toy or something. So you have to substitute the behavior you want for the behavior you don't want. And when you ask for it, they have to do it. And you teach this in a positive way.
Okay, and this is the heart of really what positive training is. And I know you use clicker training, which I have spoken about because I had Karen Pryor on the show,
cool.
reputed to be the founder of clicker training.
Yes, started it all. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, all right, let's go through a little bit of the mechanics of, you know, what you're doing. And I know you go into great detail, and so, you know, I'll definitely recommend everybody go to the book for this. But in a nutshell, what is the basis then of doing this positive reinforcement?
Once again, if let's say, for example, every time you mentioned my name, Paul, somebody burst into your office and gave you a $100 bill. The first time it happened, you'd say, what the heck is happening here? I'm doing the show. But then the person would walk out, and sometime during the show, you'd say, Paul, again, and somebody would rush in and give you another $100 bill. You'd figure out very quickly that this is the best interview you've ever had, because this guy just attracts all of this money. Whenever I say the name Paul, somebody comes in and gives me money. Eventually, the person would just stand next to you because you'd be saying the word every sentence. So that's positively reinforcing the behavior that I want. I want you to say the word Paul. And so I got you to say the word Paul over and over and over again by being positive. But let's say that you said the word Paul and somebody came in and whacked you over the head. You wouldn't say Paul for the rest of the program.
That's right. And, of course, that's what we're doing with our dogs.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Now, I really like, Paul, how you relate how quickly or easily a dog learns a behavior by comparing it to the analogy of basically what level of school, you know, your dog may be at. For example, is it in grade school or high school or college level? Can we take an example of some, you know, behavior, a simple behavior that, you know, you'd want to teach a dog and go through kind of, you know, those three levels and using, you know, the exact technique, of course, with probably, you know, using the clicker for positive reinforcement of what that would look like.
Well, and let me st- start by saying the clicker is basically the word good in dog speed. What that means is the ideal window of time where a dog can make an association. They put their behind on the floor and you give them a treat. The ideal window of time that they can learn that putting their behind on the floor gets them a treat is 2/100 of a second. So if you can imagine that your dog puts their behind on the floor and a half a second later you say, good dog, and then a couple seconds later you then give them the treat, they would actually learn it more quickly if you marked the behavior. In other words, you clicked the instant the butt hit the floor. And then the dog can, I get it. Good and click mean the same thing. It just is much more quick when you use a click.
Yes, right.
So that being said, I stopped using clickers in my first week of class, and I normally don't use them until the third or fourth week now, because a lot of people were saying, gee, I got a clicker in one hand, a leash in the other hand, a dog over here, and then I've got the leash over, all this stuff. So I normally introduce it the third or fourth week. By that time, people have better handling skills. So that being said, grade school level is in an environment without distractions. If you were trying to learn something and the radio was on, the television was on, and people were constantly yelling at you, you would have a very difficult time learning something. So you start in a non-distracting environment, and that's kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
When you take a dog through grade school, you're simply saying that you're adding more and more distractions so the dog will still listen to you while the sights and sounds and the smells of the world are swirling around. So you would then take your dog and have them sit on the grass outside where the dog can smell more things and hear more things. When your dog is successful outside sitting, then you might take your dog out in the street. Then you might take your dog to the supermarket and stand outside the supermarket. And gradually you're at a circus and your dog will sit no matter what. So when I talk about taking your dog through grade school, high school, college, it simply means adding more and more distractions of the sights and sounds and smells of the world.
That's great, because you also pointed out something that I think I was kind of ignorant about, and I know this happens to a lot of other dog owners, where, you know, you teach your dog something, it's sitting inside, it's by itself, it's got this command down perfectly. You know, you have the great story about, you know, teaching a dog to go retrieve a beer from the refrigerator and all that. And then, of course, when the dog has all these distractions, you know, whether it's, you know, that there's people over, or whether, you know, as you mentioned, it's in a different environment, and you you know, maybe offer the command, the behavior is like completely gone, and a lot of people get completely frustrated. And then, of course, being impatient, they start saying, let's say if it's down, like, well, Rover, down, get down, no, sit down, you know, and then they start, you know, just firing off a number of different commands, and of course that confuses the dog and it doesn't work. And so your idea of we must be mindful of what distractions can do to the dog, I think, was very, very wise.
It all has to do with context, and this is the big secret. There's three big secrets in dog training, and the first one is contextual learning. If you teach a dog how to sit on carpeting in your living room, and then you take them in the kitchen where there's a different flooring, a different surface, like tile or linoleum, and you say sit, the dog says, I have no idea what you're talking about. You never taught me on that flooring. If you change your perfume and say sit, the dog says, you never taught me what that smell. I had one client who was walking down the steps, and she rarely went out on dates, but this was a really big deal. And so she was coming down the steps, and she had this big flowy dress on, and she had this new perfume on. The dog wouldn't stop barking at her.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was is that the dog never learned who she was in that context. So when she said, sit or be quiet, the dog says, you never taught me when you looked and smelled that way. So the answer is that when people say, my dog is just being stubborn, my dog is just being disobedient, my dog's being willful, my dog's being defiant, all that, none of that exists. The reason your healthy adult dog won't do what you want is you never taught them in that specific context or situation. And no dog can become behaviorally reliable, and this might take some pressure off of everybody when they say my dog hasn't learned it yet, is no dog can become behaviorally reliable, which means do things at like a college level in all these different situations in the world until they reach emotional maturity. Emotional maturity for humans is between the ages of 18 and 28. My brother Tom's 54, and he's still trying to figure it out, but, you know, everybody's different. For dogs, it's between the ages of 1.5 and 3, and sometimes 4. So although you can teach a dog to do all this stuff, they're not going to do it reliably until they're grown up, until they're emotionally mature enough to handle it.
Oh, Paul, that makes so much sense. And your book is chock full of all sorts more of examples of that and their learning phases. It is time for us to take a short break. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more right after this.